What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hapness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Christoph Zürn, who has invented the method of music thinking. And we dive deep into the analogy of music and how different types of music can represent different types of organizations. Is it more an orchestra that needs a conductor, or is it more in jazz ensemble that needs improvisation? So we are speaking about the complexity of organizations and the simplicity of a good analogy and the beauty of music and the work of facilitation and all of that. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And if you want to learn more about facilitation and improve your own skills, check out the Never Done Before Academy with live online courses on various topics. neverdonebefore.org/courses. And now, enjoy the show. Hello, Christoph. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Miriam. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Very much looking forward to our little exploration into the world of music and facilitation and design thinking, maybe.
Yeah, for sure.
And I always kick it off with the same question. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
Yeah, I do. Exactly the time, I don't really remember, but it might have been, let's say, when I changed from being a creative director to freelance. And maybe the story is, as a creative director, you're the one making decisions at the very end. Mm-hmm. So you're the one, to, you know, it's not what you want. You want the team to come up with something. But if this doesn't work, you're, let's say, the decision maker of last resort. And I think there were moments where I thought, oh, I made the decision too quick. Mm. I didn't hear that person. Or, hey, this person was very quiet on that day. Or there was new information. So I think when I changed being on the payroll of an agency, going into freelance world as a creative companion, that's the company name. So that's also, let's say, a program. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, so my work is to help others to come up with the ideas and make decisions. And later I realized that there's a word for it. Facilitation.
Beautiful. And I wonder how would you now select the gigs in a way that you don't have too much of an opinion? Because I can imagine that it's very difficult. As a creative director, you're also paid for having opinions and to know what's good enough and what's not. And as a facilitator, suddenly you have to almost censor yourself.
Right. Maybe stupid to say. I think, and maybe people who know me maybe tell you totally the difference. I think I have a small ego. So I think I always like to listen. That's part of my program, let's say. And then if I don't like it or if I find something about it, I would discuss it. And okay, if we can't make a decision, then as a creative director, you do. But you have heard the other party. So on the other hand, if you do your own projects, like I had a lot of side projects that I did, then you're not only the creative director, you're also the one who's doing everything. Mm. And there I don't make any compromise. So because that's more about me than about, let's say, the others and the other side.
Yeah. So you can really switch roles. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I think that's something I'm intentionally do. So the question is, what's my role? And I also think a facilitator is just one of many roles. Mm. And you can use facilitation in different ways. So we can dive into later.
Please go ahead. Go right in.
On the other hand, sometimes you're a host. You have to greet people. You have to welcome them. And you could say, oh, that's also facilitation, but it's also very much being a host, being there as one. Or sometimes you're a teacher. when talking about different concepts, and you see that people work in a certain way, and you say, "Oh, they really don't understand the concept." So then you have to help them, and that doesn't mean so now I have my teacher hat on, and now I have my facilitator. I think facilitation brings, most of them together. But sometimes it's a role where I think in a workshop, okay, now I have to make a break and to say, "Hey, do you guys know this or that?" And then most of the people say, "Yeah." And then you see, "Oh, okay, we have to help them." Say, "Okay, for the one who doesn't know, or because I like so much to explain it to you," and then you help them. And I think that makes often a difference. Say, Oh yeah, we knew it, but we never heard it that way. So that's also for me some kind of facilitation, teaching, whatever.
Yeah, interesting. Absolutely. And I wonder whether there is a difference between facilitator capital F, where you really step into the space to facilitate a process, or whether you're a teacher or host or a trainer who facilitates.
Yeah.
And then it's small f, which is, we use the same tools, but somehow the hat we are wearing is a different one.
Yeah. And if you say big F and small f, I would say, is there also a middle F or a very high F? So it's like from pianissimo to forte, if we take musical attributes. So for me, it's not binary in that way, either this or the other, or big or small. I think it's more
So would the companion then be a middle F? Medium size F? Or what does companion mean to you?
Companion means, if you're, give it a name, a consultant, a creative, or an interim guy or a freelancer, you always start. And when you start, there will be an end of a project. It's like doing a walk together. You accompany that person to walk that way in a better way that they can't do alone. So that's companionship. And companionship is also not being the owner, but being a co-owner. So it's not about you help them, but you also, sometimes you also ask for help in your role.
Yeah.
So it's accompanying, and it's not in that way, it's not offensive to other people. So I realized when I was creative director, and you come into a company, you say, "Oh, creative director." And funny enough, if you have another kind of director in the room, it's like, "Oh, okay, now who has the last word?" And I never really did that game, because I don't like that kind of games. So I thought, why can't I be just the companion? So I'm not a dangerous person. I just accompany you. So in doing what we all agree what we should do. And if this is facilitation or not, I just came up with the name creative companion. And then the question was, hang on, do you accompany us in a creative way, or do you accompany creatives? And the answer is yes. So it's about creativity, and it's about a companionship, being a part of. And that's also very musical. Sometimes you could play in that band, and then you play in the other band. But if you play in the other band, you don't think, I would rather be in the first one. So it's like you be there, you help, you work together, but there's a beginning and there's an end.
This makes a lot of sense. Thank you. I'm glad that I asked. I have the impression that I'm decomposing now all the different parts, because the creativity, so you compared it to music. And I wonder, I think with music and with creativity, we often have these mental blocks or limiting beliefs that I'm not musical, I'm not creative. Is it similar that these are just, in your opinion, limiting beliefs? Can we learn music, can we learn creativity, or how do you help people to find more comfort in there?
I think I can help people to to remove the barrier of their limited thinking, because we all are creative, full stop. And we can be creative in totally different fields and totally different ways. So it's like understanding that that's a nature. And I'm sure Joseph Beuys, the biggest artist of the 20th century.
Yes.
And he really said, everyone is creative. Everyone is an artist, he said. And I think it's true. So, it's, you know, some people can have a boring job or thinking they're not creative, but at the end of the day, they might cook or play with the kids in a way where you think, hey, that's different than what you did at your work. And, you know, and you not necessarily have to give it a name. So if some people like to condition that they are not creative, so yeah, if this is what they want to think, but there will be moments where they are creative, sometimes to solve a problem or to just have fun or play with something.
I actually like it. It makes me think of how can we bring this hidden side of creativity more into the space once we work together, the group. So to first priming them, okay, where in your life are you creative? Are you, how do you play with your kids? How do you cook? And then how can you use this kind of energy or curiosity or mindset in a workshop or in a work context? Mm. And what does music have to do with all of that?
Yeah, you know, I started something called music thinking, and that was, yeah, I kind of tell you, actually, it's like bringing everything what I did before together. Maybe that's more like a symphony. Mm-hmm. and with everything that I did before, so I have a very very diverse patchwork CV. I like to do things. I'm a good starter, but I'm also a good finisher. So
that's rare.
Yeah, funny. If I start something, most of the time I always finish it. That makes some kind of there's some kind of pressure. But or I don't even do it again. So maybe. But if I really say, oh, that's interesting, then I will always find a way to bring it to a certain point.
Like the companion.
Like a companion. Yes.
Okay.
And by the way, funny enough, if you work for a client, they can call you back. So you can accompany them again. So if people understand that you help them to do something and that you stop and you're good friends and you might never see them again, but sometimes you do it again. Mm. Say, I would need you for another project, or I know someone who would be. And that's the nice thing to do. And actually to draw the analogy here is like, it depends on the kind of musician that you are. So there are musicians like in a certain rock band, you just start the band with your friends and then you stay for it forever. So I think there are many groups that do it that way before they break up maybe. But more in jazz or also in classical music, you play in different ensembles.
Mm.
Sometimes in classical music, you see if you go to a concert and you have three pieces that they play, you see that they change from piece to piece. And some people play in that piece and not in the other. Some others come in. And that's also the way how things go together. And if you're in jazz, it's very common to play also in another band. So yeah, that's my way of thinking is like, if I think like a musician, then that's more easier to co-create because musicians are natural collaborators. And if I think in ways of design, then it's most of the time more a specialty or anything else. And nothing wrong with design. I was working in design quite some decades. But music is just the overarching thing for me. And I realized that this also helps me and my clients to understand better what they do.
Mm, and I would like to peel the onion a little bit because there's so much in there in what you just shared. And maybe starting with musicians are collaborators by nature. And somehow it's funny because I can think of the crazy composer who is just by themselves in their little room to compose music. But then obviously they're composing it for someone else to bring it to life. And they're the musicians who are playing the music or even with the band composing together. So what is this mindset or skill set that then would help us outside the music?
Yeah. So yeah, that's the core of what I want with music thinking, because otherwise I would have called it just music. For me, it's like the analogy. And what you just said, maybe I should stop with calling something a musician, because there are many different types of musicians. And like we just talked about in the roles of the facilitator, sometimes you're that's facilitator, and sometimes the big F, small F, middle F, and any variations in it. But if I look at the field of music, what you just said, like in organizations and talking about leadership, you often hear, let's say, the then metaphor of a conductor, the mm-hmm. one who tells all the others what to do. And I never use the word metaphor, because I always use an analogy. Mm. And because metaphor wants to make a point. So this is this. And because this is this, that is that. That's mm. what metaphor does. Politicians do this. And they say, oh, we just do captains of industry. Oh, yeah, captains of industry. It's like a big boat. There's one person with a different kind of hat, and he's the one who making all the decisions. And that's why we should do. But analogy for me means like, okay, if what we are doing in a project, in a workshop, or in our organization, what kind of musical genre would this be?
Mm.
How many people are playing? How did they come to this, what we just heard? And then you will see from, oh, we could go into the direction of, let's say, classical music, where one composer writing everything down, giving actually instructions mm-hmm. for other people. And there are people that are trained to read the instructions and play it in a perfect way. And you need a person that helps them to train, helps them to hear the music before they can play, helps them to understand what are others playing while you are playing this or mm. while you're not playing, and helping them in the performance to synchronize. So that's one kind of music. And you could also see, if you want to do this in an analogy, you could say, oh, that's maybe a multinational. So there's a big organization where we are organized. Let's take Wagner's Ring with, I don't know, 250, no, even more people on stage and a choir and people, let's say, in the orchestral pit. How do you bring these people together? So that's a big organization. And there you don't improvise on the stage. On the other mm-hmm. hand, you could say, let's go more into our century where everyone with a computer can make music with all the tools that we have, and then go into the studio, and then you have the leadership role of a producer. A producer, most of the time, like the conductor, also does not make any sound. The conductor doesn't make any sound. That's interesting. Mm. Sound is made by the people itself. It's like, if you again want to also put in the analogy of the facilitator, you could say the facilitator is also not making any sound in between airports. Yeah. He's the one coordinating based on the briefing, let's say the score from the composer or however you want it, and helping them doing this. But if you're a producer in the studio, you also have to understand when to make a break, when to send the people, let's say, go record store shopping to get new inspirations, to come in with a new mind, or to say from, hey, maybe we could invite that person for that part. So you're just more, it's completely different. It sounds much more like a marketing-driven organization, because mm-hmm. the goal is to sell the record. That's what a producer does. And it's like, if you're just a multinational and you write everything down, then it's the performance on stage. In the studio, you just do this for any other different way of where the music will be heard. It could be a playlist, a composition, or, whatever. And both of them don't make any sound. If we go into another segue into another field of music, like improvisation, like Baroque music. Baroque music, like Bach and Handel and even Beethoven in his early days, he was a cool improviser.
I would have not thought of these, thinking of improvisation. I would have gone in the jazz direction.
Yeah, let's start.
Yeah, please continue. I'm intrigued.
And because and it's a very long answer to your short question, I don't use it as a metaphor. I just want to open the field of music and then try to find out, okay, how does this sound in blues? Okay, there's a certain structure like in Baroque music or in traditional jazz. But hey, what if we go to free jazz? We get on the stage, we take a moment of silence, and then someone starts playing and the others play too, and they segue in ways that you could not have composed. Mm-hmm. So it's the moment. And the improviser is also making a noise. That's a difference in improvisation. So it's much more a startup or a smaller unit. And sometimes you don't know who's the leader, who's the follower, and because both of them are very much in the dynamic. And if we segue again into another field, and then we might go into the field of, let's say, indigenous music. Mm. Let's not forget that there's music that is not heard or not heard as much on Spotify or any other commercial thing. There's music at home. People make music at home. And sometimes it's from a tradition. They just you have a guru if you talk, let's say, talk about Indian music. And if you go further, like Australia, the didgeridoo, or mm-hmm. so, or the shakuhachi in Japan. So there's a big field that draws a lot from the tradition and the meaning, what it should be. And it doesn't change by every trend or everything else. And most of the time, the guru is the master of play. So they also make a sound. And that's actually when I opened the field in that way, the question is like, how do you sound as an organization? Where are you?
And what is the purpose and the goal? So is it conservation, like in the traditional music? Is it improvisation, creativity, innovation? Or is it effective functioning, like in the orchestra?
Right. And everything are good. That's the good thing with music. No, one is not better than the other. It's just different for different purposes.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I recorded a podcast with Sam from Song Division. And what they do is they invite groups to compose their own music that would represent them. It reminds me of that, what you just described, that a team or an organization first has to think of what kind of music are we actually. What would be the right analogy or the right box for us to fit in?
Right.
And then it's interesting because pushing it further of what you touched upon is then also the kind of people you need are very different. So someone who's willing and able and maybe even passionate of following processes and scripts is someone very different of someone who enjoys the improvisation, who hears maybe just the rhythm, and then has the musicality to improvise along with it.
Right. So there are different types of musician. And what you see in the analogy, if you have a classical composition, it's written out until all details, and in some way it doesn't work. And then you would ask, let's say maybe half an hour before they go on stage, you already can put the curtain and say, oh, wow, it's full house today. And then you ask them, okay, now the third part that doesn't work today, you just improvise, you guys. So if we put that analogy, I think everybody understands from, okay, that might not work because the people maybe are not trained to improvise. Yeah. But if we use the analogy in business, sometimes we ask them to do.
Oh, I love that. This is very powerful. Thank you. And I also see how then the facilitator is not a one-size-fits-all. Because someone who's very good in facilitating a change process or a digital transformation for a multinational requires very different skills than someone who does an innovation workshop for a startup where they're more improvisers in the space.
Yeah. And how do you let them, if they choose improvisation, how can you let them improvise better or in more multiple ways? So that's a little bit also like ideation. If you only have a few ideas and you tell the people think creative, that doesn't work because it's still, let's say, they still think very creatively in their box. Yeah. So we have to come up with different boxes like musical genres that you say, okay, this was now, let's say, blues. let's go to Trip Hop or to whatever one of the Spotify's tracking more than 6,200 different genre types. So, and that's in analogy. I think there are also so many different types of businesses. It's not always that business. Everybody's business is different. So why do you always go into this big directions and don't understand yourself, you know, how you're sounding as a business and how, and by the way, who's your audience? Because that's, that should be a fit. So you can have a lot of fun making music by yourself, but at the very end, it's a performance.
And if nobody listens.
Right. And a performance has a beginning and an end.
Yes.
And if you have had a great performance, it's no 100% guarantee that next week it will be the same performance with if you don't rehearse and just work on your instrument during the week.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit sometimes different to design. Design is less performative. It's more a product and then it's ready and then you ship it and then some other people sell it. And I think in businesses, we are never have one product, we are performing every day on different levels. And that helps us to, that's why I think music for me works better, because if we had a big success, it doesn't mean we have it tomorrow if we just lean over and do something with it. It's just now we are on level two. This means we have to work even harder, because there might be a level three. We don't see it, but it could be. And yeah. It's like the quote of Pablo Casals, one of the biggest cello players in the world. And when he was 90, I think the story goes like he still was rehearsing every day for 5 hours. And people ask him, you're the biggest cello player in the world. Why are you rehearsing every day? And his answer was, I think I can be better. So there is something in performance, meaning you must have fun to perform and not just to lean over and do it again, maybe.
Yeah. And again, there's so many ways we can dig deeper into that, because what does it mean for we can always be better, and rehearsing must be part of the process always. So how can we rehearse the creative process, the coming up with ideas, maybe even, and how can we help those who might be stuck in a box? How can we help the orchestra players to lean into improvisation, so that if the conductor, one of the players is sick or cannot join, how can they fill the gap and deal with this disruption? Because that's eventually what we need, right? Even if we are a multinational with all the processes, if something goes wrong, we still need the machine to function.
Right. I think to answer that question, if there is, let's say, one of the soloists is ill and you can't get another, you can't play the song.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that understanding what a producer does in the studio might be much more interesting for big organizations instead of always looking into classical music. And for me, often when I hear this, like, oh, we need a conductor, someone who's really organizing this, then I would say, okay, but then do you have a composer? So no, what do you mean? So the question is, why need a conductor if you don't have a composer? Or you would need a conducting composer. Gustav Mahler was one of the biggest conductors in his time, but he wrote great symphonies. So okay, that's what. So it's about understanding. If you dive into the analogy, it gives you a vocabulary to talk about your own business in a different way.
And can you help me understand what you mean in business terms, the differentiation between the producer and the composer, and what it then means if you have one or the other or both?
Yeah, I think that's the easiest way if we would have an example. But just to answer the question on a general level, there is someone who is creative in writing down instructions what others should do. And there is a person that is so cool in letting people work better together.
Like a scrum master.
For example. So the whole agility is a part that is very interesting, but it's only interesting if you understand what to do. agility is on efficiency and not on effectivity. Effectivity comes before when you write the score and when you test it and when you go and when you rehearse it and when you let people...
Because the effectiveness is focused on the outcome and the efficiency is the way of working.
Right, right.
And these are two different skills.
Yeah. So we can also segue into design thinking. So design thinking is pretty good to understand why are we doing this, and maybe, air quotes, maybe less in making it very efficient. In that sense, design thinking is less efficient, but very effective.
But
if you're very, very efficient, like in agility, it could be you're very efficient in making a very mediocre thing very quickly, very good in time, in budget, that has not the effect that you want, for example, that people buy it and like it and use it.
Yeah. Fascinating. And that's such an important question to ask. I think many, especially small businesses and solopreneurs, forget to ask whether they're focusing on an audience or clients who are abundant in time or abundant in money. And usually they're never both. They either have lots of time, but not so much money. And then you can have long processes that are effective. But if the client is abundant in money and short in time, you better be efficient.
Right, right. But it means you have to be sure secure with each other that what you're doing has the effect that it should have.
Yeah.
And we are in business, and as a facilitator, sometimes you facilitate something where you think, oh, wow, this was a great workshop. Everybody has the eyes and said, wow, this was great. But you know that on Monday, they try to sell it to the management and they will fail. Because every organization has an autoimmune system of things that are new and they refuse it. So if you don't tackle also, let's say, the branding aspect or the organizational aspect, which for me, it's more or less the same, the brand experience, the product experience, and also the experience with the organization should be one. And so if you just leave it out and you just do tests with clients and the client says, yes, I want it. Maybe the organization says, yeah, I understand, but that's not us. We don't do that.
So does this mean that in a design thinking process where usually you have interviews, you empathize with the audience, with the clients, external clients, you are suggesting that it's equally important to also test it with internal clients?
Yes, and even with the brand itself.
Yeah.
So I heard it so often that when in service design and service design, you're focused on the end client. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's your focus. You won't say, okay, they want it, they would buy it, and they would use it. And that's an important one. It's not only just about selling. It's about selling something that is meaningful, that they use it so that their lives gets better. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we ruin our planet with stuff that no one needs. So that's the important part. It's very important, and you're not ready here. The thing is, how does this also add to where we all say that our brand is for?
Mm-hmm.
How does this add? We could do something that is tested perfectly with a client. They love it, they want it, but it might not fit our purpose. Should we do it? Hell no. Otherwise, we ruin our brand. But we need money. Hell, we have to do it. So, and that's something, if you understand that when you do it, it will have an effect on your brand because people say, oh, they're now doing this as well. And that is less where they are known for. So there actually is a change without knowing that you're changing.
This is a very interesting conversation relating to the neutrality of the facilitator. So would you think that this is your role as the companion or facilitator to also know, maybe before you start the process, to know where are the guardrails, what is the canvas, and where does it stop? Or are the participants and the client, the stakeholders, responsible for knowing, okay, this is maybe too much of a stretch?
Yeah, it's a stretch anyway. Why shall we make our life easy when everything is complex. So why not make it complex so that it will be easy at the very end?
What do you mean by that?
You know, what I hear often in organizations that we have projects to make stuff more easy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Simplicity. We need simplicity.
Facilitation.
Mm-hmm. Right. But the funny thing is, if you make it simple for yourself as an organization, I can guarantee it will be extremely complex for your client.
Because they have to do the translation work.
Whatever. So the funny thing is, okay, if we want simplicity as a brand, it's not for us working efficiently. We have to be effective for that the client has the idea this is simple. And often this means that we can't do any shortcuts in our organization because it will have a negative impact or even a complex impact. But because making it simple like facile, so facile, doesn't mean, and I think that's a misunderstanding of the word simplicity as well. Mm. The question is from, yeah, let's do it simple. Now that's too much to complicate it. But the question is, what do you want to achieve with this? And if your complication also leads to complication for your client, then I would say, okay, now we have to talk. But if your simplicity doesn't solve the problem, then I'm a service designer very much again. So then I would say, okay, but why should you do it? Because it's too complicated. It's in this will not work. But because we put everything in so little boxes, that's the advantage of agility, so that we get work done. On the other hand, if the box is small enough, you just lose the connection to the big whole. And you just deliver what's on your plate for this 2 or 3 week sprint.
True. And I think to bring something to simplicity is very complex and requires a lot of work. And this is the ultimate beauty. And I guess that you can also find similarities again with music.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
the simple patterns when you, listen to the piano of Bach. It's so simple.
Yeah, it's very so complicated. It's very, very, but maybe there's another one that we could use here where I think the analogy works pretty good. It's like if we talk about an orchestra, where you need many people with great instructions, like a score, and someone who helps them to get the best out of this music together. But if you can't afford it, you can sample it. Yeah? Then we're going into the direction of the producer. We sample it. But if we perform it, there will not be an orchestra. There will just be a big loudspeaker and we will hear a similar sound. It's not one-on-one. But this is something where I say, okay, if you want that, you know, music is open for any remix of this. But the source might be orchestra, but the way how you do it could be either sampling or with electronical instruments. You can create it in the same way so that it sounds equal. So it's not different and the performance will be different because as a DJ, you're standing more or less alone on your DJ pit. And in an orchestra, you see the 100 people on stage and you hear different things when it's live. Not just that one big sound, but it helps to make it cheaper, better, and maybe also for a different purpose.
I love the analogy. There's so many layers and you can go in so many directions because you can also outsource parts, record them in different studios, put them back together. Yeah. And what do you think makes a workshop fail and what makes a music performance fail? And are these the same or are they different?
That's a good question. I think a workshop in that sense is not a performance, but maybe more a rehearsal. So maybe, didn't think about this before. And there is a performative element in workshopping and also in rehearsing. But it's not the performance for the client. So I think that also is open for making things wrong, making mistakes. And if we don't want to make mistakes in a workshop, I would say, okay, then you might have not needed the workshop. So if there's just a smooth way going from one way to the other, then yeah, maybe we missed something in, or our bias was too strong, or not the right people in the room.
So a rehearsal that could have been a paid performance,
yeah,
is not worth a rehearsal. So I was just trying to translate the workshop where everything goes smooth and we have a perfect product at the end. Maybe we didn't need the workshop.
Hang on, that's maybe something else. Then we have to shift again more into improvisation, because improvisation is a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it could also be a rehearsal. But that works differently than if someone writes something down, organizes 100 people, and let them play in some way together.
Yeah.
And by the way, I learned in university that if you really want to understand the music, for example, classical music, go to a rehearsal.
Ooh.
You know,
why that?
Why that? Because then they stop and say, no, can we do 24 X again? And your horns, you were just a tick too hard. Okay. And then you hear from, oh, I didn't hear this. I know. Oh, okay. So you understand music much better when you're part of a rehearsal. Sometimes there are open rehearsals. And then you also see how they work together. And yeah, that's very interesting.
As much as you learn about the functioning of a team or an organization, if you go to their workshop.
Right, absolutely. But in a rehearsal of an orchestra, it's very clear. So they don't have enough time. Okay. They have time books. They have an expert, and everybody has to do what the conductor says. But and the conductor, by the way, just to be clear, the conductor is also a trainer. He's also an educator.
Mm.
He's the one who knows the piece best and how it should sound. And it's about committing also to this and helping to create that sound together. And it's not about the individuality, like one of the second violins in the last row. They say, okay, I only have to do this. That's not interesting. But it's an essential part of the whole. So that's also something. So what you do, it's not only about how you feel at your moment in doing this, because it's a part of the whole.
And it's not necessarily about doing a lot or being very loud. And right. Still having a very important part in the result and the whole.
Yeah.
I like that. So for you, what makes a workshop fail then?
Yeah, fail is, I think there are different kinds of fails. So sometimes as a facilitator, your job is to have a smooth workshop, that everybody is happy at the end, and that they come up with the ideas that they like. I would say that that's where you're most of the time hired for. I would also call it a fail if I have the idea that this is just more like, let's say, design thinking theater. We already had that idea before. And now we need a workshop to tell other people that we use design thinking for this idea because it's so good. So
design thinking theater, I've never heard that.
Oh really? So
it's like classipulation.
Yeah, I didn't invent that. But it's something like doing something for, yeah, let's say the strongest voice in the organization. Say, oh, let's do design thinking these two weeks, sprint or 2 days, and at the very end, the result is actually what you already knew before. But now you also put your design thinking sauce around it, and you can tell, yeah, we ask real people. The question is, are they real people? Were they real clients?
Did we really listen?
Right. Did they really listen? Did we really listen what they say? Or did we, yeah, we might have listened to them, but maybe we didn't understand what it meant. So yeah. So that's something where I think that would be at the very end a fail. And it could also be a fail like what I mentioned earlier, like you work on something that the client wants, but the organization doesn't want or need to make the organization better or the brand. And that will also always be a fight. But maybe that's not a fail. Maybe that's more an insight.
Or reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe I'm a bit sarcastic here. I think one of my biggest frustrations recently is when I work with a group and they're enthusiastic and they're having an outcome at the end. and they put their best people to it. And then after the workshop, they realize that actually the organization hasn't foreseen a budget to actually implement it, or hasn't foreseen that the people, in order to do the work after the workshop, need time for that.
Right.
So even there, there are different layers. I think, yes, the solution could be not a cultural fit, but then it could also just not be implemented for so many other reasons, for instance, budget.
Right. Well, I have to say, it's like insights. Every outcome can help you to either understand the organization better, your client better, or processes better. So I wouldn't say it wouldn't be wasted money, but it's maybe not clever as an organization to do it that way. And it could also be like that you learn how that kind of workshop works, so that the next time you can allocate the budget. So I wouldn't say that this is worthless, or let's say no reason to be sarcastic.
Yeah.
But it's like, from, you know, there's a quote from Otto Scharmer about theory U, you know, systemic thinking. And he said, you can just understand a system when you try to change it.
Mm.
And that's something like, if you do a workshop like this, you try to change the system, then you realize, oh my God, that's the system. Here's the red line. And then if you know the red line, next time you can think about, how can we do this different, so that that red line might be a little bit further away, or maybe a dotted line, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, true. And you can only change the system from within. And therefore, it's so important to really engage and empower the participants so that they become the change agents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think that's over time, and now realize, and I become more and more aware and forget less often to also have the conversation with the client then. Do you have a budget?
Yeah.
What is the plan afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's the, yeah, that's often the biggest thing, because the budget is allocated with people that are mostly not in the workshop. They have a different dynamic. They don't understand it. And the question, or maybe the next workshop should be, how can we, or how might we find, given the fact that this workshop in this way is such a great thing, how might we help our organization to see the effectivity and also the impact of what we're doing, so that we can plan different kinds of workshops in the, I don't know, next half year or whatever. That's a challenge.
I love that. And I can see a fantastic design thinking process around it, where they actually interview the people within the organization who have to do the work, who have to find the budget.
Yeah. And also ask them what they think. So it's also like, I had it with in workshops or in trainings where there's a dynamic with service designers, and, you know, we want to solve problems. We want to make it better for the client. And empathy is one of the cues that I'm using very much. But empathy doesn't mean only having empathy with the end client. Empathy also means having empathy with your organization, with your boss, with the CEO.
Mm.
So there, empathy is not a one-way street. Oh, empathy. Oh, I see what you need. No, hell is, I see what you need. I see what the organization need. I see. And then let's make this as visual or audible or whatever, make it clear for everyone. Okay, this is, and then we're closer to sometimes complexity, but we need to understand the complexity until a certain amount, so that we can make it simple for us and for others. But if we are only focusing on, let's do a workshop. How much time do you need? In 2 days, we can fix it. And, you know, stuff like this. And then, you know, in 2 days, they can't fix it, because in 2 days, they come just with the inside, what's the problem and how you could solve it, but you don't fix the organization. So everything has to be connected.
Yes. I love the different layers of empathy. Also empathy with ourselves. Because if we come up with a solution that kind of itches, or we don't want to implement, and or which will break us because we don't have the time and capacity, also won't work.
And also, is it good for you?
Mm.
Is it good for doing a workshop or anything? I also have workshops, or did workshops, where I had one or two moments during the workshop where I said, why am I doing this? And if you have this every day, you should change something. Yes. But I will not say that this is unnatural. It's also always good to be critical with yourself.
Yeah.
And say, okay, yeah, it brings bread on the table. But if this is your only argument, you will have maybe a lot of bread on the table, but nothing else. So, or you don't want to eat it anymore. So you have to understand, if you don't understand yourself, how can you understand other people? And if you cannot understand other people, how can you understand your organization? So it's all the same. No, it's not the same, but it's connected. And they're different perspective. And that's where music comes in. Music is very good to hear different perspectives at the same time. I can hear the violin, and while the violin plays, I can hear the horns. I can even think, oh, there's even a drum after it. Or, oh, now the contrabass comes later. So this layered thinking, that's really something that you can develop while listening to music and then understanding from, oh, it's like our organization while we're doing this. The loudest part is here, but there's a small part there, and it's changing over time. So it's also the joy of listening to yourself and to the organization and to yourself in the organization.
Mm. Yeah. And the awareness that everyone has their place and not everyone wants to be the first violin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, last week, I recorded an episode on personality types and the elements from Chinese medicine. And now I wonder whether there are also personality types related to an orchestra. Are you more of the contrabass that is more for the in a band, which is more for the rhythm, or are you the first violin?
I had in my podcast, I had one guest. She is doing, like, say, what kind of instrument are you? Or a friend of mine who is also working with this, what kind of instrument are you? And making connections with certain traits of behavior and attitude linked to a musical instrument. And the one I just thought about was she's doing a survey. And before the first meeting, she gets some results from the survey, and this is assigned to a certain instrument. So like from, hey, you're the saxophone because this, and this is more typical for the saxophone. So for me, there it stops, because for me, then it goes a little bit too much into a metaphor. But anyway, if it works for people, be my guest, because I can think that every instrument can have different traits. You can play a violin in thousand ways, or a saxophone in thousand different ways. But let's keep it simple, although it's very complex. Let's keep it simple. Say, okay, that a saxophone, you have to use your breath.
Mm.
And if you're out of breath, you have to breathe in again. There are tricks like circular breathing, but that's another case. So, and as a violin, you can play one note very long, because if you do this, you don't even hear when I'm just, you know, it's just about bringing the resonance to the violin. And the question is, okay, some people like this more and some other people like that more. So I think instruments, and for me, it helps to think about this without making maybe too much conclusion, so that, oh, you're such a trumpeter.
Yeah. I like the distinction you make between a metaphor and an analogy, and let's not be too dogmatic or prescriptive for that.
I sometimes ask people in the beginning of the workshop, if you would be a musical instrument, what would it be?
Mm. It's a beautiful warm-up question.
Do you have an idea, Miriam? What would be your instrument?
I think I would be a piano, because although it's very structured, there is a clear structure on how to play it, and still you can improvise and use it in different ways. And yeah, I think that's
Do you like the overview of the piano, so that you can see the field, what you're doing?
And yes, and there are clear boundaries of what you can do and what you can't do.
Hey. And there's a rhythm, five and of the black and the white keys.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's not go too much in that, but that's something like as a starter from, oh, that's interesting, because I use...
What would you be?
I'm a saxophone anyway. Yeah. But that's also my instrument. So that's a part of me. But the thing is, you don't see what you play.
Mm-hmm.
I feel this. Yeah. Okay, as a pianist, if you look to, but it's a different way to have it here or to have it there. And I need my breath. So it's a different way of being. So for me, the saxophone is more an extension,
mm-hmm.
a musician then. But as a piano player, you can't carry it and
yes.
have your instrument there. But that shouldn't be a problem. But every time that you come there, you have to see from, oh, wow, I see the 88 keys, 35 black, 53 white. So that's what I know. Okay, it's a piano, and then you play on it and say, oh, wow, ooh, but it doesn't sound good.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what you then do with it. So there are different ways.
Yeah, and it needs some sort of stability. Can I put it everywhere?
Yeah, right. They're bigger and smaller.
Yeah, need space.
Right. But anyway, just as an example, to ask people and then elaborate on it. What do you like with it? What do you dislike with your choice of the
yeah.
instrument? And how many instruments do we have in the room? Oh, we have 8 pianos. Okay. So it's also like you can bring them together in thinking about this.
Yeah, and I think if there are 8 pianos, it's a fantastic opportunity to then dissect into what makes your piano, and what makes your piano doesn't need to mean the same thing as for the other piano.
Right.
And what I also like about this icebreaker question is that it helps you to speak about yourself without being too intimate and personal, because you're still speaking about the musical instrument. The piano needs a lot of space. Not me. It's just the piano. And hence it really facilitates a conversation where people can go sufficiently deep without being all too vulnerable if they don't want to.
I think that's something in my experience I use a lot. So, you know, I made a whole framework about everything. There's a book, there are cards. But at the very end, I start with the people themselves.
Mm.
Ask them,
yeah.
do you want to share 1 or 2 songs? And then sometimes I don't even ask them to share it right away, but just to keep them in their head for a moment. Just everybody one song. So you can do this with a big group in the room. Let's say I did it once with 100 people, everybody different song. And then I was talking about music. Like if you have a song now, maybe Miriam in your head or even the listener now could say, make a choice, just pick one song. And then you can ask questions. How many people are playing? Is it one, like let's say a singer-songwriter? Is it an orchestra? Or is it, let's say, the Fab Four, like a quartet? What genre is it? Is it pop, rock, jazz, trip? Is it, and how is it produced? Is it instrumental or is there singing involved? If there is singing involved, is it English or is it a different language? So these are questions that you can ask, and you see that everybody's doing like, and most of the time, because it's popular music, most people have a song that it's around 3 minutes. That's what we're conditioned to. Most of them is with vocals, with voice. And in my experience, when I'm doing this, it's 90% is English. And my question would then be, if you choose a song of 3 minutes, how do you do strategy if your attention span is, let's say, 3 minutes? And if your song has vocals, how would it be if there would be no vocals? Is there music that you like without vocals? And what would it be? So you start with them, and that's the cool thing. So I don't have to do anything or bring there. I'm doing this later and then with sound elements or bring in music as well, because people expect this. But at the very end, the real story is in their heads already. And to activate this and bring to the table and let them say, hey, what was your song? Oh, I had this. Oh, I had the same. And the question is, wow, what could be our bias in listening if the two of us were, let's say, 80s rock and there's a singer and it's English. Say, okay, what would be a different listening? Let's find out if there's someone has something different and let's share. Why did you pick this? Why did you pick that? And then people say, yeah, I could, you just asked me one. I could have also used this. And that's fine. It's not about being right. It's just about sharing who you are and also developing your vocabulary. And then what you just said, then you can talk about music, but at a certain moment say, hang on, actually, we're talking about our organization. And it gives us new ways to talk about something without being vulnerable on the one or let's say intimidating for someone else.
So if I understand you correctly, so this would be the warm up to build a shared vocabulary and to get a sense of what we're talking about, to then apply it onto the organization or the team or whoever is in the focus of the workshop.
Yeah. I did one workshop in Paris with the European Parliament and with the Secretary General. And then you ask them this question and then you facilitate the conversation. So don't moderate, you just facilitate the conversation. And then you see that people say, oh, I am here, because there the question was different. You also can use this for an organization. We just talked about the leadership positions like a conductor, like a producer, like improviser, or let's say the indigenous part. What kind of leadership would we need for the next year, for example? This is a question. And then you could also open the field and let people stay in the room. You know, we really can make it visual. And then you would see from, oh, I thought we would need more, let's say, score, more rules, and we would need someone to help us to make this at the very perfect high level. But I see my colleague or the CEO, he's on the improvisation side. I don't get it. What does this mean? Then you get into a discussion, and that is very close because you have these two layers, the music layer. The music player, you just have chosen what you think it is. And again, it's not right or wrong. It's just interesting. And then you have a discussion together where you try to understand different positions at the same time, because everything is about the same organization.
Yeah.
And if you can help them to talk about this, then you can also work on... Yeah, on other things that are more focused and that are more connected. And then we leave the music and the music thinking aside. And then we really go into nitty-gritty details that we didn't solve the last week. But it helps us to open the field to really say, oh, there are so many variations. But at the very end, it's very clear where we are, more or less.
Yeah, and what we need, depending on where we want to go. Yeah, thank you. What remains your number one facilitation challenge?
And with challenge, you mean a situation where I...
Whatever you want to tell me.
You know, the most challenging is if you have a very strict briefing with very limited time and there must be an outcome, then you're more on a functional level and really helping them to achieve what they want. But if you do this very long, you know, you can do this, you help them, the client is happy. And sometimes you think, why didn't they do this by themselves? But we know, because if you're part of the group, you can't facilitate, because it's not easy for you. It's not budgeted for yourself, because you have people see you as a person and not, maybe you should bring in five heads or whatever. But yeah, I think that's one thing, but that's something that does not interest me so much. I want to open the field, let people, when they get out of the workshop, that they're something like, oh, okay, that was not only different, but I'm also more connected in what I already am. And that depends on the kind of workshop. That's often not a service design workshop where you just try to help them, then you're maybe more a trainer or an educator.
A conductor.
Right, the conductor. and in another, and I'm an improviser. I play since 40 years free jazz.
Oh, wow.
Well, and that means I'm very much used to get on the stage not for rehearsal, but for performance, not knowing what I play or what the others play. Mm. And because you've done this so often, your ears get very, very, very big. Because then you have to pick up something that's worth elaborating. And you always look for yourself, what you play and how you play. But while you play, you have to listen to the others, but also to the sum of everything, because you want to create a music for everyone. And if it was good today, there's no guarantee that it will work tomorrow in the same way, because that's performance. That's something, but that's more the musical part. And I love it if I'm in workshops. You know, when I was in the Design Thinking Center at a certain time, I always wanted to be the co-facilitator, because I wanted to help the facilitator to make hours and to do this good. And if something goes wrong, then I step in. Mm. And I loved it if nothing happens and the facilitator could tackle everything. And I loved it maybe even more now, maybe also if something really was like, oh my God, that's really something that I'm experiencing for the first time. But that's something for me, then I'm on. Then I have to react and do it. And that's more for me personally. I understand very good organization or the orchestras, and I love them all, but as a person itself, I'm much more an improviser.
Beautiful. And how you explained what you, the skills you need as an improviser, the big ears and knowing what's happening and being reactive to it. These are beautiful skills to learn as a facilitator or anyone who works also within a team. And it reminds me of improvisation theater. Just similar. You have to listen a lot and then
applied improvisation. So there's also many big groups. So the Applied Improvisation Network. So there's a lot of good stuff going out there. So yeah, that's really perfect. My thing is, or my analogy is music, because that's why I'm experienced most in. And it's very inclusive. So it's there are so many links to everything else, but listening, and it's such an open door, but listening is such an important thing. And you might know from John Cage, 433, that's the piece where no one is playing. Mm. That's a famous piece from 1950.
4 minutes, 33 seconds. Is it the one?
4 minutes and 33 seconds. Yeah. So. And the idea is that, and it's not a joke. That's maybe, it's funny, but it's not a joke. Or some people think it's funny. For me, it's pretty serious. Because it gives you a time frame of 4 minutes and 33 seconds to listen what is already there.
Mm.
So you don't have to do anything but listen. And that's something you could also start your management meeting or the workshop with 1 minute, or to make it easy, but if you really do, 4:33, of silence, or let's say of non-intentional sound. So this means everyone who listens is asked not to do an intentional sound. So meaning like a joke or, and you just listen to what's already there. And in that way, you can reflect, what do we also have as an organization? So what is not the problem, or what is already here? We don't have to listen for comprehension to understand it. We just have to listen for enjoyment, like, oh, is this the refrigerator? Or is this, I hear an aeroplane. Wow, that's really distant. And then you can also use it like, try to imagine if you hear the most distant sound, like the aeroplane. Imagine that now you are sitting in this aeroplane. I think you get the idea, but this listening, and you can do it everywhere. Open the window and just listen for a minute. And that's the basic, because it will always be there also when you make intentional sound.
Yeah.
It will still be there, but it's not so loud.
What I find interesting in this is the difference between starting a meeting with a meditation or with listening, where meditation is basically only listen to yourself, but maybe, even stop listening to yourself. So detach from your thoughts. Whereas the listening activity seems as if it was the same from the outside because it's silent, but it's very different because you're focusing actually on everything that's outside of yourself instead of inside yourself.
This is something that you can do. You can ask people, take 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and listen and write down everything that they heard.
Mm.
And you will understand that some people will say, I heard the sound of my saliva, or I heard the sound of my neck. And these are also sounds. So there are sounds. Mm. So it's, if you listen really, the most distant, then you can ask them what was the most distant. And some people might have heard the airplane, that might be the most distant one. And what's the closest sound? And this will be individual for everyone, because I heard my, and someone else heard something else. Yeah. And then, oh, but that's also always there. So it's just a bit of awareness. And talking about meditation, it's called sonic meditation. And there are instructions for this. And there will be a book, I think, in the very near future, where on 365 days, different people from all over the world have given sonic meditation text instructions. And that's to remember Pauline Oliveros, who came up with this idea. And sure. There's... And the most famous one is from Pauline Oliveros. She said, if I get it right, it was, get out at night, go out for a walk at night, and walk so silently that the sole of your feet become ears. That's the instruction. And then you get out. And then you get back in. So it's also about embodied listening. So on listening with your ears, it's you listening with the whole body. And then, you know, I'm fascinated about everything with music, as you can maybe feel. But my thing is then the analogy. So hang on. If we would really listen to our organization now,
be here,
what is the closest to us? What is the farthest to us? Do we have influence? Now, and so on. You can imagine what you want to do with it.
Beautiful. So
it's the doing. And going, bringing the facilitation, you can help people to do it themselves. So you really help them to experience something that they already knew, because what's new at listening? Everything is doing at the same time, every day. But the funny thing is, we also listen in our sleep. We close our eyes.
Mm.
Our body is maybe lying there, but our ears are always on. So we get information. And that's why I used listening as one of the faces and not as a step in my framework, because listening goes through all the other faces through. And that's also the analogy with music, though. There's always the listening part. And the listening for me is like getting any data into the organization and not just... Yeah. Inning and making something with it, but trying to understand how this continuous information comes in and what we do with it. And when do we say, not now, like when we sleep, we say, hang on, now no concentration, we just want to sleep. So we just switch our brain off, the ears are open, but the brain says, no, that not. Or in a conversation, that's the cocktail party thing. There's a lot of things going on. That's also information. And if people says your name, Miriam, then you turn around.
Yeah.
Because we recognize what we already know. And it's the same with music. We like music that we already know. And if there's something new, then
familiar.
So
yeah, we like familiarity. Wow. Thank you so much, Christoph, for sharing your perspective into the world of facilitation service design.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And I will put all the details on how to find you and reach out to you in the show notes. And did you want to share something about your cards?
Yeah. So 5 years ago, I had the idea, how can I let people be more creative? Let's put it like that. And I came up with cards, and I called them gem cards. So that's a box. And even the size is also very musical because it's exactly a 45, one of the old 45s. And these cards have different triggers. And there's also one audio trigger. So if you can even scan it while on a Zoom call, and then you get to hear something. And I'm doing something called Serendipity Lab in the beginning of a workshop. So everybody has to bring their headphones or their earbuds, and I let them do 15 minutes or 20 minutes to think about their how might we question or their unanswered question or however you want to call it, and let them be open for triggers. So they hear something, they see a quote on the backside, there's a trigger questions or let's say a keyword, and ask them to write down everything that pops up in their mind, like, oh, I have to buy milk because whatever, it doesn't matter, just to be open for serendipity. And I had the idea, so if someone wants to, would like to, you know, the cards are sold worldwide. So it's, you just have to go to Amazon or to your local bookstore. But I said, if you want, I have 5 sets of cards. So if someone thinks, oh, I'm interested in these cards, maybe just write an email to you, Miriam, and tell you how they want to use it or why they want to use it. Just one sentence is enough. And then we do a raffle and send out 5 of the gem cards. Beautiful. So
yes, and we'll add the information to the show notes. So if you would like to use the gem cards in your facilitation in life, drop me an email. And then fingers crossed, you'll be the new owner of the cards. Thank you for this generosity, Christoph.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Wonderful speaking to you. Thank you for staying tuned and for listening until the very end. I hope that you found the inspiration and the wisdom that you are looking for. And I hope that you will subscribe to the show so that you never miss any of the interviews with another inspiring facilitator from across the world. I'm devoted to continue this podcast and to deliver weekly an episode that maintains the quality that you expect and you deserve. And if you would like to help me to maintain this quality and to keep the podcast free, please help us. Visit workshops.org/support to make a small donation to keep the podcast free. Thank you so much. I hope to be in your ears next week.